Thank you. So I don't know if I'll be able to live up to the standards or the expectations that Sean set up in his email, but I will do my best. As some of you may know, I'm leaving Santa Barbara in 2.5 weeks.
Oh, no.
So I thought it would be, I'm actually really happy and very excited to be able to speak here just before I go about something that I'm very excited about. So what I'm going to tell you is a prediction that you can make that I think is very robust for something that in heavy ion collisions, a peak in the photon spectrum that I think could be observed at LHC. So that's the goal of the talk, to tell you about that. And the plan is to start with some introduction and motivation. Then I have to tell you just a little bit of background about certain type of phase transitions that happen in holographic models for QCD-like theories. Then we'll move on to how you calculate photon production by a strongly coupled quark gluon plasma in these models. And then I'll address the key question, which is, can this be, is the magnitude of this effect that I'll tell you about big enough that it can be observed in a real experiment where they collide heavy ions, like at RIC or LHC? And I'll conclude then with a brief summary and a discussion of some future prospects. So by the way, feel free to interrupt me anytime because the point that I'm trying to make is very simple. So I think we have plenty of time. Excuse me. So let me remind you, as I always do when I give a talk of this type, that QCD has been with us for 35 years, if you count from asymptotic freedom. We have, to date, no way of solving it. We have no truly systematic and analytic methods to study some of its properties.
What about the lattice?
The lattice is very good for thermodynamics or equilibrium properties, but it's not very good for transport properties, for example, or other more real-time dynamical properties. And even if it were, it's still a black box. So as a theorist, I'd like to understand the theory better than just putting it on a computer and calculating a mass for the proton, for example. So a long-standing hope has been that if you reformulate QCD as a string theory, that's actually going to help you to shed some light, at least conceptually, on a lot of these issues. And to date, we have now very concrete and a lot of examples of equivalences or dualities between gauge theories and string theories. But unfortunately, QCD, because it's asymptotically free, it's weakly coupled in the UV, and that regime cannot be described using supergravity. You have to do string theory. And we don't know how to do string theory in the relevant supergravity backgrounds. So what does this mean for this program? That means that if you're interested in certain quantitative observables, say, for example, what is the exact hadron spectrum at zero temperature in QCD? That will most certainly require going beyond supergravity. You have to do string theory. However, that doesn't mean that certain predictions that you can do within supergravity are not going to be universal enough, and I'll tell you what I mean by that in a second, or robust enough to apply to QCD, at least in certain regimes, and actually understanding what predictions, namely what observables, and for what regimes in QCD they will be applicable is part of the challenge. So let me give you an example of what I mean by a universal prediction. You've all heard about the ratio of the shear viscosity to entropy density in a deconfined space for gauge theory, a quark gluon plasma. You know that in string theory, if you calculate that for all the examples we know of duals to gauge theories, you always get 1 over 4 pi. And I want to emphasize that the reason I'm calling this universal is because that holds for all the non-abelian plasmas we know with a gravity dual, for which we can do a calculation of strong coupling. And that means plasmas in different number of dimensions, not just 4, with or without fundamental matter, with or without a chemical potential, etc. There is absolutely no counterexample to this ratio being 1 over 4 pi in the limit of large N and infinite coupling. So if you're an optimist, that suggests a prediction for QCD just above the deconfinement temperature, if you believe that QCD just above the critical temperature is going to be reasonably strongly coupled. Because after all, it's a theory that at the critical temperature undergoes a fast crossover into a confining phase. So it's certainly suggestive that it's going to be strongly coupled. We have no way of calculating the shear viscosity coming back to Jim's question, either on the lattice reliably, because it's a transport coefficient, it requires real-time formulation, not a Euclidean formulation. And we don't know how to calculate it analytically in QCD at that temperature because it's strongly coupled. But we can do experiments. Like at RIC, we collide heavy ions. We create a little fireball of deconfined plasma, which expands and subsequently hadronizes. And by measuring the result of in your detector of all the particles you get, etc., it seems that there is strong evidence that the quark-gluon plasma created at RIC is, first of all, strongly coupled. And secondly, it has a ratio of eta over s that's very close to 1/4 pi. And what I mean by close is that it seems to be certainly much closer to this infinite coupling result than to any perturbative QCD calculation. Any questions so far? Okay. So let me make a couple of observations about this result. First of all, when this was calculated for the first time in April 2001, the authors who calculated that had no idea that this was going to be a universal observable. And so my point there is that not knowing should not discourage you. It was not until 2003 that people started realizing that this was going to be a universal observable. But more importantly, the reason why this is universal is because both eta and s are related to a property of black hole horizons that's universal. So for example, the entropy density is just the area, and the shear viscosity turns out to be proportional to the absorption cross-section at zero momentum. And that's also proportional to the area. So the ratio is, of course, a universal quantity. So the point to take away from this slide is that the reason this is universal is that the gravity dual of a gauge theory in a deconfined phase always contains a black hole in that background. Okay, so deconfinement means a black hole horizon. And I'll give you a heuristic explanation for that in a second. So what I want to do in this talk is combine that universal property with another universal property and see how far you can get just using those two facts. Because if it follows, anything that follows from those two facts is bound to be rather universal or robust. And the second property that I want to use is that if you want to model, remember we're working in the large N limit always. So if you want to introduce, and typically the theories we are modeling with just gravity have no matter in the fundamental representation of the gauge group. They only have adjoint matter, okay? So no quarks. The point is that if you want to introduce a small number of flavors, small number of quarks, much smaller than NC in the large NC limit, as you should do in the toothed limit, you can do that by introducing open strings in that background, namely D-brains. So let me explain this point because it's important. First of all, if NF is much smaller than NC, you can treat the brains as probes and neglect their back reaction on the geometry. So you're studying just the reaction of the brains to the geometry, but you don't consider the back reaction on the geometry. And the idea is that the closed strings that you started with are dual to states in the gauge theory that are gauge singlets, gauge invariant states, constructed out of only adjoint matter or gluons, okay? For example, glue balls. Whereas once you have open strings, each open string must have if you have an open string with both endpoints on the D-brains, each of the endpoints is interpreted as a quark and an antiquark. So now you have bound states of quarks and antiquarks, fundamental matter, namely mesons. And now you see why a black hole in the background corresponds to a deconfined phase. Because if you don't have a black hole, whenever you have an open string with one endpoint on the D-brains, this open string can wander off in the bulk, but eventually it's forced to come back to the D-brains because its endpoint must be on a D-brain. So that means that whenever you have a quark, it's always accompanied by an anti-quark, and they are bound together. That means that there are no free quarks, okay? Only gauge invariant states like mesons. If you have a black hole, then the string can actually wander off and fall through the horizon, and once it does that, it's not forced to come back. So this state here is a deconfined finite energy quark. And that's why a black hole corresponds, tells you that you're in a deconfined phase. Are there any questions so far? Okay. Yes.
Are you going to tell us if there is a different temperature for confinement and splitting the mesons up, you know, in the picture, the argument you just gave?
I will actually indeed tell you that in the next slide. Yeah. So if it's not clear, ask me again.
That picture seems to indicate that whenever you have a black hole, the mesons cannot be confined.
No. Let me get to that. So far, what I wanted to do is to convince you that if you want to understand the physics of mesons, or fundamental matter more generally, in the deconfined phase, what you have to do is look at the dynamics of D-brain probes in a black hole background. Okay? Now, as soon as you think about that, now, and let me emphasize a point that I didn't say before. The distance, the asymptotic distance between the brains and the horizon is proportional to the quark mass, because if you, of course, it's proportional to the length of the string, which sets the quark mass. Whereas the size of the black hole horizon is, roughly speaking, proportional to the temperature. So as soon as you realize that, you also realize that there is going to be a phase transition between this situation and this situation. Over here, the quark mass is sufficiently larger than the temperature in such a way that even though the black hole is pulling down gravitationally the D-brain, the tension of the D-brain can compensate for that. And so the brain stays, bends a little bit, but it stays outside the horizon. On this phase, the temperature is sufficiently high, or the quark mass is sufficiently small, in such a way that the tension cannot compensate for the gravitational attraction, and the brain falls through the horizon. Okay? Now, in between, it just happens that there is a critical embedding at which the brain touches the horizon. And so if you know that, you may suspect that this is going to be a second order phase transition, because there's an interpolating solution in the middle. But in fact, if you do the thermodynamics, you discover that that's not true. There is actually a first order phase transition. If you start here, and you start lowering at low temperatures, and you start heating up the system, the black hole horizon grows. And eventually, the free energy in this phase is equal to the free energy in this phase, and the system jumps without going through here. Is that clear? Good. I want to emphasize that this is not a confinement-deconfinement phase transition, because on both sides, there is a black hole. So the glue is in a deconfined phase. There is no area law for the Wilson loop, for example. The difference between these two phases is just in the physics of the mesons. So let me explain that, coming back to Gary's question. So let's ask, what is the spectrum of mesons, QQ bar bound states, or not, in both phases? Over here, if you look at small normalizable fluctuations of your D-brains, as you know, normalizable modes in the bulk correspond to physical states in the boundary. So the idea is that tiny little strings that are attached have both endpoints on the D-brains. Those don't break just because there is a black hole in the bulk. Okay? They are attached to the D-brains, and in the limit in which you only look at the massless modes, those are just fluctuations of the fields living on the D-brains. Those are the fields that appear in the Dirac-Bohn infill action. Is that point clear? In addition to that, this phase also has massive finite energy quarks, which are strings stretching from the tip of the brain down to the horizon. So the fact that you have deconfined quarks doesn't mean that there are no bound states of those quarks. So two very heavy quarks can bind in a much lighter state, which is a meson. And in fact, the reason it is much lighter is because you can calculate the mass of these mesons, and you get that it goes like the quark mass over the square root of the tooth coupling, which is very large in this approximation. So these are very, very deeply bound mesons. And the reason for that is that if you have a quark and an anti-quark, those have a mass that's proportional to this length. But once they bind together, that string can actually curl up and be just attached, be a very tiny string attached to the D-brain. So its length is much, much shorter, and therefore its mass is much, much smaller. Okay? And actually, this scale, this meson scale, also sets the scale for this temperature. The temperature at which this phase transition takes place, which I'll call T fun, or fundamental, is set by this scale. Okay? And let me also emphasize that on this phase, in the approximation of large N and large coupling, both sets of excitations, the mesons and the quarks, are are absolutely stable. The width, for example, of these mesons is zero in this approximation. The decay width is zero. That's just because it's infinite N and infinite coupling.
So the mass of the quark is proportional to the length, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why is that ratio is 4 by square root N? Where's the radius dependent on?
Say that again.
The mass quark?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
The ratio I thought it depends on what is the distance.
Yes. These two masses are the same up to a dimensionless constant, which happens to be the TUF coupling. This comes from solving the wave equation for normalizable modes on the D-brains. That wave equation is sensitive, the scale in that wave equation is sensitive to the radius of anti-de space, which, as you know, is determined by the TUF coupling. So when you do the calculation, you get precisely this relationship. In order to do this, you actually don't even need to solve the equation. You just need to define dimensionless variables, and you see that what sets the scale of the meson masses is this combination here. Yeah, it's for a similar reason, for example, for why the string tension in confining models has a square root of the TUF coupling in it, or the Wilson loop has a square root of.
It came from the
case. Yeah. Yeah.
This is really a feature of the strong coupling limit.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, that's right. So let me finish the slide, and then I'll tell you why, for certain aspects, you should regard what I'm going to tell you with a skeptical eye at best. For some other aspects, you should take it very seriously.
So the stability of that, I mean, you're at finite temperature, so physically you expect that there is some probability that the mesons will get hit by.
That's right. That's right.
That's what subleading you want to
forget. So there are two types of effects that give these mesons a width. One is 1/n effects. For example, as you know, this black hole is going to Hawking radiate, but that's a 1/n c squared suppressed effect. But if you take it into account, then one of those quanta can hit the meson and dissociate it. But that's suppressed by 1/n c squared. There's another effect, which is an instanton transition in which one of these strings can dissociate in one of these. And that's suppressed exponentially in minus the square root of the TUF coupling, because it's an instanton effect. So you can estimate both of them in order of magnitude, but of course, calculating them exactly is very hard. And in any case, we're working in this approximation. So in that approximation, they're absolutely stable. Okay. Now, one of the important messages of this talk is that in this phase, there are no quasi-particle excitations. This is not a system that you can understand in terms of quasi-particles. This is really a fluid, strongly coupled fluid. It's a liquid. Okay. And I'll give you
quasi-particles on the left side.
So over here, at least you have quasi-particles that are given by the mesons. So, and I will be more precise about this when I calculate a spectral function for you. You'll see that on this side, the spectral function, which measures the density of states, is completely structureless. There are no peaks or narrow resonances. Over here, it's a sum of delta functions for the mesons. So this statement that for quark masses that are sufficiently larger than the temperature, the mesons remain bound even though you're in a deconfined phase, means that they survive deconfinement. Now, this is not something new. This is well known to people who do lattice QCD. There are a lot of caveats in these calculations in lattice QCD, but let me tell you what the lattice people would tell you. They would tell you that if you look at bound states of heavy quarks in the plasma, say charmonium states, CC bar states, like the Jape Psi, which has a mass of 3 GeV, they would tell you that the temperature at which this meson dissociates is way above the deconfinement temperature. Remember that the deconfinement phase transition in QCD happens around 175 MeVs. And they would tell you that this survives up to a range that goes between 317 and 403 MeVs. Okay?
What does this mean? I mean, it can't be absolutely stable because you could always be hit by a hard gluon and break apart.
Absolutely. What this means is that they compute spectral functions and they see,
they see a peak. Recognizable peak.
So even in the vacuum, this guy is not completely stable. He has a width. But what they see is that that spectral function is not very strongly modified above the confinement.
Also, if it breaks apart, that could be unstable to recombination.
Right, well, I mean, it's all, right, I mean, it's in a thermal ensemble, so it's going to explore all of its
yeah.
states over time, right?
I'll come back to actually recombination. That will be crucial for this effect. So this is the range they give you, and of course, I couldn't resist plugging in numbers for this model. And what you get is this range down here. And you see that this number, this lower bound, is exactly the same as this one if you exchange the 7 and the 1. So I hope that this convinces you that you should take this very seriously.
Some domains that would be taken as an argument.
I agree. I'll give you better ones, hopefully. But the point is that some of the physics of these mesons you should regard as with a very, very skeptical eye. For example, the Jape psi in QCD is not deeply bound. Okay, the binding energy of this guy is way smaller than its mass. Whereas these mesons are very, very deeply bound. Okay, that's a fundamental difference. However, let's see how far we can get. At least, for example, the fact that the mesons survive for large enough a quark mass is a universal prediction. And that seems to be true in QCD. So I'm going to come to other aspects that are also rather universal. Is this clear? Good. So let's then move on to the main topic, which is photon production. Why are we interested in photons produced by the quark gluon plasma? The reason is because actually, I was in a conference on hard probes of the quark gluon plasma last week, which was very hard. And they call these guys the historians of the plasma. Because the point is that photons interact very weakly with the plasma constituents because they only couple electromagnetically. Of course, the electromagnetic coupling constant is very weak. And the firewall is finite in extent. So a very quick argument will convince you that the firewall is actually optically thin, which means that once a photon is produced, with probability almost one, it escapes without subsequent interaction. And so it carries away very, very valuable information about the point of emission, such as, for example, what was the local temperature when it was produced. So this is probably one of the best probes of the quark gluon plasma. So we would like to understand what is the rate, for example, of photon production and the structure, the spectrum of photons produced at strong coupling. That's the motivation. So how do we calculate that? That's actually very simple, because the rate of photon production per unit momentum, unit photon free momentum, is given by this standard formula, where this piece here, this is the electromagnetic coupling constant. This is just the usual statistical factor. And the interesting part is the trace of the spectral function, which has to be evaluated at null momentum because we are looking at on-shell photons. Okay, so this k is a four momentum with components energy and free momentum, which are equal. And this chi is just the imaginary part of the retarded correlator of two electromagnetic currents. Okay, so diagrammatically, what you want to calculate is this diagram here. All right, that's the probability. If you cut it open, that would be the amplitude for anything going into a photon. So when you square it, you get the two-point function of the electromagnetic current. Okay? So the punchline is that all we need to do in ADS-CFT is be able to calculate a two-point function of an electromagnetic current in a black hole background in the presence of these D-brains. And that from that, by plugging it back into this formula, we get the rate of photon emission and the spectrum. Okay? So that's the calculation we want to do. Yes? Very good. Thank you very much. Yes. This formula is exact to leading order in the electromagnetic coupling constant. But to all orders, in the strong interactions if you calculate the spectral function exactly. So in this diagram, you could, in principle, so in real QCD coupled to electromagnetism, the gauge group is SUN cross U1, where that U1 is a dynamical photon. So in principle, you should allow, in these loops here, also photons running in the loops. But those will give you contributions that are higher order in the electromagnetic coupling constant.
You use U1 is weakly coupled, but SUN is strongly coupled.
Yes, yes, yes. So I'm going to calculate the rate of photon emission to leading order only in the electromagnetic coupling constant, but exactly at strong coupling in the non-abelian interactions, which in QCD is supposed to be an excellent approximation. That's because basically there's a 1 over 37 suppression in higher corrections. So I'm not going to do the calculation for you, but let me tell you how you would do it, at least conceptually. So in the gauge theory, if you have NF flavors of quarks, and for simplicity, you take all the quarks to have equal charge, electromagnetic charge, and equal mass, then the theory has a global UNF symmetry that rotates the quarks into one another. And the overall U1 there is what you would call the baryon number, U1. These are global symmetries in the gauge theory, which, of course, by the duality, you know, are mapped to gauge symmetries in the dual theory, in the gravitational description. And this UNF is nothing but the gauge symmetry that lives on the Wahr volume of NF d-branes that represent the dynamics of the quarks in this description. Okay? Now, for each global symmetry, in particular for this U1, there's a conserved current in the gauge theory, the baryon current, which in this case, if you take all the quarks to have equal mass, that's the same as the electromagnetic current. Okay? That's the one in QCD you would like to gauge and couple to the photon. Now, that one is just the overall U1 subgroup of the UNF gauge symmetry on the D-brain. So that's the one we are going to concentrate on. So in order to calculate the two-point function, the retarded correlator, all you need to do is evaluate the on-shell action for the D-brains and take two functional derivatives with respect to this gauge field. And that gives you the two-point function of the dual operator, which happens to be this electromagnetic current.
U1B is the position of the D-brain, right? It came from the UNF.
Yes, yes. Because you know that conserved currents are always are operators that are dual to gauge fields. Okay, in the gauge gravity duality, there's a dictionary between operators on the gauge theory and fields on the dual gravity description. And one of those ingredients in that dictionary is that conserved currents always couple to gauge fields. Sorry, the dual field to a conserved current is always a gauge field. Now, this global symmetry is dual to the gauge symmetry on the D-brains. And so that means that each of the conserved currents associated, a global symmetry here has a consequence, which is that there exist conserved currents, which are, in fact, NF squared of them. Okay? Each of them is dual to one of the gauge fields on the D-brain. Okay, so in particular, the global one is dual to the global U1 on the D-brain.
You just call one U1 gauge current as some electron wheel. That's what you call.
Say again?
You call some U1 gauge current, gauge boson. You call this as an electron wheel.
Electromagnetic. Yes. Yes. So this is dynamical in this description, but it's just an external source for this current in the boundary. Is this point clear? I'm just applying the usual prescription for computing two-point functions. Any more questions about that? Okay. So before I tell you what the result is, let me make a couple of comments. The first one is that I will only calculate for you the spectral function on this type of embeddings. And the reason is that you already know what the spectral function is going to be on this side. Remember I told you that the spectrum is discrete, and there's a mass gap on this side. And these excitations in the spectrum are absolutely stable. They have zero width. So the spectral function is just, which measures the density of states, is just the sum of delta functions located at the corresponding values of the masses for these guys. Okay? I'm going to come back to this point in a little while, but let me just make that comment to start with. And the second comment is that I will focus on the dependence of the spectral function on the quark mass, and there is no way to compare that to perturbative QCD. And the reason for that is that in perturbative QCD, in all calculations that have been done to date, one always assumes that the thermal mass of the quarks is much bigger than the bare mass of the quark. So effectively, people set this to zero in their calculations. But I'm saying this because I want to emphasize that regardless of the regime of applicability of this approximation, it assumes that there are quasi-particles in your system which are narrow enough that you can attribute to them physical properties such as a mass or a thermal mass, okay? And I'm claiming that is not the case here. That's why I'm emphasizing this point. And this fact about the non-existence of quasi-particles is very, very important to people who work in trying to understand the quark gluon plasma, because if there are no quasi-particles, you have no intuition whatsoever coming from the gauge theory side. So they are actually very, very reluctant to accepting this, even though I think they are coming to terms with it. So. Okay, so this is the result for the spectral function. So let me guide you through it. What's plotted here is the trace of the spectral function, which is what enters the formula for photon emission, as a function of the dimensionless photon energy. Okay, omega is just the photon energy divided by the temperature. And the reason I'm only plotting it as a function of k-naught is because, remember, the three momentum is equal to k-naught because we're looking at null momentum. So there's only one variable. And the different curves here correspond to the result for different quark masses. Okay? So the one at the top corresponds to massless quarks. This little m is just the quark mass divided by this combination. So it's dimensionless. Okay? It's the ratio of the quark mass to the temperature, essentially. And as you go down, that means increasing values of the quark mass until you reach the point. Remember, I'm computing this for black hole embeddings. If I make the quark mass too large, I jump through a first order phase transition to the Minkowski embedding, where I told you that this has to become a sum of delta functions. So first comment is there's absolutely no structure or narrow resonances in this spectral function or peaks that you can associate to quasi-particles, to long-lived quasi-particles, okay? And the second point is, how on earth does this turn, as I increase the quark mass, eventually has to go over to a sum of delta functions, okay? How does that happen? So let me show you how that happens. Yes. Sorry? Here? Yes, so actually, because I'm plotting chi over omega, this is actually a conductivity, the electric conductivity. And the reason it goes to zero, or it becomes very small here, is because as you increase the quark mass, the induced horizon on the brains is becoming smaller and smaller. The neck is smaller. And as you know very well, the conductivity is associated to the dissipative part, which is... So I don't mean to say that this is flat. What I mean is there is no peak. Yeah. So there is information, but there is no quasi-particles in the system.
When you compute this, you use incoming wave boundary conditions at the horizon?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The usual, the Sohn and Steinitz prescription. Okay, so in order to show you how you go from this to the sum of delta functions, because that's a crucial point, let me remember we were computing the spectral function in this phase. And I told you that if I increase the quark mass too much, I will jump from here to here through a first order phase transition. That's what the thermodynamics tells me. But let me ignore that, okay? And let me explore what is the spectral function when I go into the metastable or unstable phase approaching this critical embedding. So I'm going away from the thermodynamically stable phase, but locally I can do that. I can supercool my system and ask what is the spectral function, and then ask if I reproduce what I expect in this phase, okay? And the answer is yes. So here, for example, it's the same plot as before. The red curve is when you just entered the metastable region. As I push the system further and further in this direction, I get the green curve, the blue curve, and the purple curve. And I could go on, and these peaks become higher and narrower. So this is the appearance before your very eyes of quasi-particles in the spectrum. And the reason why this toy model I think is very nice is because I don't know of any other system where you can add strong coupling, calculate in one phase and in the other phase, and see how the quasi-particles just appear as you do this, as you go from here to here. Okay? Now, one point that we have to emphasize, and that you probably should have complained about, is the following. Remember, we are computing the spectral function at null momentum. Okay? The momentum is light-like. And I told you that on this phase, there is a mass gap and a discrete set of mesons. So those correspond to time-like momenta. So where are these peaks coming from? And the answer to that comes from looking at the dispersion relation for the mesons. And that's a crucial point that allows you to make contact with the heavy ion collision experiment. So let me explain that. The statement, this is what's plotted here, is the energy of a meson as a function of the free momentum of the meson, namely the dispersion relation, in some arbitrary units, for a pseudoscalar and a scalar meson. But the same, a very similar curve would be obtained for vector mesons, for example.
This is in Minkowski
embeddings. This is in Minkowski embeddings, thank you, yes. Because I'm trying to understand these peaks, what are these peaks approaching? Okay, so the statement that there is a mass gap is the statement that these lines hit the vertical axis at a non-zero value. Okay, that's what the mass gap is. A mass gap means that at rest, okay, in the absence of any free momentum, the excitation is gapped. But now you can ask, how does the energy change when I increase the free momentum? And you get a curve like this. And what you observe is that over here, this approaches a straight line with a velocity which is smaller than the speed of light. It's smaller than one. Okay? And I'll tell you in a second why that has to be the case. But immediately, you deduce by continuity that this curve must cross the light cone, the omega equals k curve line. And that means that for each meson in the spectrum, that meson has a state in which it's moving with some free momentum for which omega is equal to k. Okay? And that state is contributing a resonance peak to the spectral function. So if this was a relativistic dispersion relation, these curves would always be above the light cone, and they would never contribute to the spectral function for on-shell photons. Okay? So another way of saying this is that at this point, because of the medium-induced modification in the dispersion relation for the mesons, these mesons, at that point, can just decay into an on-shell photon. So say this could be a J-psi, and here it has omega equals k, so it has exactly the same quantum numbers as the photon, and in terms of an effective theory, this is just an effective vertex in which it can decay, and the strength of that vertex is determined by the spectral function. Okay, so this is what gives you the peak, the resonance peak, in the spectral function.
No mass gap, then this postponement doesn't exist. If there's no mass gap,
well,
the blue line is always below this.
No, it, even if there is no mass gap, it would still. Oh, I see. Yeah, they would cross at the origin, right? Yeah.
This is only happening if there's a mass gap.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay, so. Indeed, I want to emphasize that this dispersion relation and the fact that it crosses follows only from two facts. From the fact that mesons survive the confinement, namely there are states that I can ask about for the dispersion relation, and the fact that asymptotically the limiting velocity is subluminal. Okay, that already tells you that they must cross. Okay, but why? So that could be true in QCD, irrespectively of whether QCD has a dual string description. But why does this happen in the string description? That's actually really simple to understand. This limiting velocity is just the local speed of light at the tip of the brains. Why? Because if you look at the wave function of these mesons, Remember, these mesons are excitations that are supported on the D-brains. Okay? If you look at larger and larger free momentum, these mesons become heavier and heavier. And so their wave function becomes more and more localized at the tip of the brain, because that's where the gravitational attraction is pulling it to. And here, because of the redshift associated to the horizon, the local speed of light is smaller than the speed of light at large values of the radial coordinate, namely at the boundary. So this limiting, just a second, this limiting velocity is just the local speed of light at the tip. Gary.
Yeah, my intuition is backwards here. I mean, I would have thought that you're going to very high omega, so you're looking at very high energy from mesons. If I put a meson at the tip, then the redshift that you're saying is the greatest, so that would seem to lower the effective energy as seen from infinity.
No, let me say maybe a little more technically. What you do to look to find this dispersion relation is you look at some fluctuation of the of some field, let's call it phi, on the D-brains, which depends on T, X, and R. Okay. And because even though the plasma breaks boost invariance, you still have translation invariance, you expand this in this form, omega t ikx times some phi of r. And this is the radial wave function of your meson. Okay? And what I'm saying is that for very large k, so what you do is you substitute this in the linearized second order differential equation for the fluctuation. And you ask, for what values of omega and k do I get normalizable solutions? Okay. And then you discover that for very large k, if you plot this phi of r, you discover that it's completely peaked and supported at the tip. And at least my intuition is what I said, but perhaps your intuition is different. We can talk about it. But certainly that's what happens. Okay, so the reason I'm emphasizing this is because this dispersion relation follows, again, from universal properties. I'm only using the fact that the brains are sitting outside the horizon and there's a redshift associated to the horizon. That's what gives you the limiting velocity, which is smaller than the speed of light, and that means that they have to cross, and so, and therefore you get peaks. Is that clear?
This means that as we go more and more to the critical range, the brain almost hits the horizon.
Yes. It's what?
Velocity?
Yeah, it goes to zero. Yeah. So here, the limiting velocity would go to zero, but that's not a very physical thing to do. The only reason I was pushing it in this direction is to show you the transition between here and here. Okay? Because if I just jump through a first order phase transition, you won't see what's happening. Okay, so to summarize, this is the spectral function. The red curve is for a massless quark. Remember, for massless quarks, there is no structure. For very heavy quarks, you get this peak associated to the effect that I just explained. And then if you plot the spectrum, not just the spectral function, but the spectrum, namely multiplied by the statistical factor, you get the usual curve. The red curve is the thermal spectrum, the spectrum of thermal photons emitted by a massless quark in the plasma. The blue curve is the one associated to very heavy quarks. And the sum of the two has this peak, which you can see with your naked eye. Okay?
Sorry, isn't that peak what you said you get only if you go into this unstable or thermodynamically unstable phase?
No. What I was saying is that I wanted to explain here. So if you start calculating the spectral function here, you don't get any peaks. You get a structureless spectral function. If you compute it here, you get a sum of zero width mathematical delta functions. You get a width, but very narrow peaks if you go into the unstable phase. And I just did that to illustrate that you go over to delta functions. But
the peak that you're going to use now, I mean, the one that you want comes from where?
So the one in real QCD, these mesons don't have zero width. So this is a toy model.
Oh.
This phase, where your mesons survive the confinement and are absolutely stable, is a toy model for the real mesons in the corpuscular plasma QCD, which know about 1/n effects and know about finite coupling effects, so they have a width. But the idea is that that's not going to be very important.
But the plot that you just showed.
Yes. Right. That's right.
What is that?
Good. This is indeed for an unstable embedding. This, if I were to do this for the Minkowski phase, this would be a delta function. And then here, I would get this delta function and down.
If you're using that unstable phase as a model for real world.
Just for illustration purposes, because if I draw a delta function, you won't see it. And moreover, moreover, in an experiment, you will not be able to measure the frequency with infinite accuracy. And so the only thing that matters is the integrated yield over some finite range. So the only thing that really matters is the residue of the delta function, the coefficient of the delta function, which is basically the area underneath the peak. So whether it's a mathematical delta function or a narrow peak doesn't really matter for an experimentalist. Okay, so everything I've said so far applies to a plasma that's infinitely extended and in thermal perfect thermal equilibrium. Okay? The real question is, in the real experiment where you collide these heavy ions, everything evolves in time, the temperature drops as this thing expands and so on, can you see this effect? Okay? So let me try to convince you that yes, you could. So first of all, let me emphasize that, as I said before, this effect does not rely on whether or not QCD has a dual string description. It only relies on two assumptions. One is that vector mesons, remember, because they have to mix with the photon, okay? So they have to be vector mesons, spin one mesons. Vector mesons survive the confinement. That means they may have some small width, but they still exist as sufficiently narrow resonances, okay? And this could be checked, for example, for the J psi or the upsilon, so a CC bar bound state or a BB bar bound state. This could be checked either in the lattice, and actually people claim that they see them, or in models where you have an effective potential at finite temperature and you solve the Schrödinger equation and you find to what temperature they survive and so on. Okay, that's the first assumption. And the second one is that they have a limiting velocity in the plasma for propagation which is smaller than the speed of light. That's also quite plausible in QCD for the following reason. Let me give you the argument. Suppose that a meson, one of these mesons, at rest, survives up to a temperature 2 times TC, okay? Twice the deconfinement temperature. If now this meson is moving, because of the boost, it sees an effective temperature that's higher than the real temperature, okay? By this Lorentz factor. So when this effective temperature, which depends on the velocity, reaches 2 TC, which happens, for a lower real temperature, this meson will dissociate. So in other words, mesons with a high velocity see a higher effective temperature and they dissociate before mesons at rest. So it is plausible, this is not a proof, but it's plausible that there is a limiting velocity for a meson for each given temperature, okay? So if these two things happen, then you get a dispersion relation like the one I drew, and you get that it crosses the light cone and you get a peak. Now, if you want to compare with heavy ion collision experiments, you need a model for the space-time evolution of the fireball, and you need to understand the number, the abundance, and the distribution of J psi or upsilons in the plasma. And my conclusion, after reading papers for 3 weeks and going to this conference, is that this is very, very little understood. Okay? There are lots of models and people don't agree, or they only agree on the fact that it's not understood. That's a completely, I think, fair statement to make. So what I'm going to do is to just to convince you that it's plausible in one of these models, you would get an effect of order one. So it could be a peak that you could see at LHC with your naked eye. So let me try to explain that. Okay. So this model follows something called statistical recombination. So in this model, you imagine, as it is the case, that at some initial time, there's this collision between the two heavy ions. And At that point, what happens is that these very highly energetic partons, the quarks and the gluons in the ions, collide, and they create lots of particles. In particular, they create some number of C and C bar quarks. Okay. Now, after a short time, which people call the thermalization time, which we will take it to be T equals zero, the light degrees of freedom, namely the U and D quarks that were created in this, and the gluons that were created, reach thermal equilibrium. And that's the starting point. That's where the quark-gluon plasma phase starts. Okay? At some temperature that we will call Tmax, which at Rieck is about maybe 2 Tc. At LHC, it could be 4 Tc. Now, the C quarks, the mass of the charm is 1.5 GeV. Okay? And this temperature could be something like 300 MeV. So it is not very unreasonable to assume that the C quarks do not chemically equilibrate, but they kinetically equilibrate. That means that their number is fixed, okay? However many you produce in initial hard protonic collisions, that's the number that you get, and they don't get created or destroyed because the temperature is too low. But of course, their distribution in momentum may follow some Boltzmann distribution. That's the assumption. Then, when the temperature starts dropping, at some point you reach something that we call T dissociation, which is the maximum temperature at which the Jape size, say, can exist before dissociating. Over here, the temperature is too high. At this point, some fraction of C and C bars recombine, and they form Jape size, which then exists in the plasma until you reach the hadronization temperature, okay, the 175 MeV, where everything then becomes hadrons. And then there's some subsequent flow of these hadrons into your detector. Okay. Now, here it's important. So I'm going to tell you now what are the different sources of photons, because you need to be able to distinguish between them if you want to identify this effect. So here you not only produce CNC bars and everything else, but also what people call perturbative QCD photons. Okay, these very energetic partonic collisions create lots of photons. Then these guys, the light degrees of freedom in the plasma that have a spectral function that has no structure, they also emit photons thermally. So that's a thermal background for us. Once the Jape psi forms, you get this peak, a new channel opens up, and the spectral function then receives this contribution, and that's the signal we want to compare to the rest of the background. And finally, here, when you hadronize, for example, you produce a lot of pions, etc., and these guys can decay, emitting further photons. So those you have to subtract. Okay? But this seems to be something that the experimentalists tell me that they can do. More or less reliably, they can subtract the decay photons. By looking at the invariant mass of the pion, they can identify what pair of photons came from a decay of a pion, for example. So I'm only interested in comparing the relative magnitude of this effect to this one and this one. And if we get that they are comparable, then this could be observable. That's the goal. So let's start by comparing this to that. Okay? So we need to understand the evolution in space-time of the firewall. So the volume, for that, we're going to use a very simple model that people use in the community, and which seems to capture the essence and the main features of this hydrodynamic evolution, which is constant velocity expansion along the beam axis. So you model the firewall as a cylinder, and accelerated expansion in the transverse plane, okay? Where these parameters are parameters that you feed phenomenologically, and that we don't need to know here where they are. And then, if the viscosity is small, as it seems to be the case, then the entropy is pretty much conserved. You don't generate much entropy. And then the entropy is proportional to the volume times T cubed. So that tells you that the temperature drops like 1/3 the volume to the 1/3. Okay? Now, the background for these guys is then given by the integral over time from the initial creation of the quark-gluon plasma to the hydrogenization time of the volume times the statistical factor times the spectral function for the light quarks. Okay? The complicated thing to evaluate is the signal. because that's given by the contribution of the jape size, which only comes in at T dissociation, up to hadronization. And then it's exactly the same as this, but there is a, something called a fugacity factor here, which accounts for the fact that the C and C quarks are not chemically equilibrated, but only kinetically equilibrated. Okay? So let me explain this formula a little bit more. As I said, this is the fugacity factor. And what I want to point out is that it's proportional to the number of CC bar pairs produced in the initial hard collisions. And this enters quadratically. And that's very important. Okay? Remember that. Now, for the spectral function, for the jape psi, inspired by everything I've said before, I'm just going to assume that it's some peak, for simplicity, a Gaussian peak, around what I call omega peak, which, remember, was the frequency at which the two dispersion relations crossed. That's the point at which the jape psi can decay into the photon. So that's where the peak is going to be localized. The complication is that this dispersion relation depends on the temperature. Okay? And so this crossing depends on the temperature, and the peak at which the jape psi is contributing changes, the location of that peak changes as the temperature drops in the firewall. Okay? So there's a lot of dynamics here that you have to take into consideration.
The crossover from the mass gap to this line must have some dynamical input, right? Is that the string?
The crossover from what?
So you put it on the curve from the string line, so you can track.
Which one?
The blue one.
Good, good, thank you, yes. You need to parameterize this. So to do the real calculus in QCD, as you're very right, I would need to know the dispersion relation as a function of the temperature for the jape psi in the medium, which I don't know and nobody knows how to calculate. So what I'm going to do is to note that in all holographic models, so let me tell you what you use. This is what you use. This is this formula, this is the dispersion relation. This formula fits the holographic models within 5 or 6% accuracy, and it's motivated by the following. This second term is just the vacuum dispersion relation, but with a different limiting speed. It's not the speed of light, but some other speed of light, sorry, some other speed velocity that's smaller than one. And the first term is just a constant k-independent shift to guarantee that at k equals 0, this is equal to m, where m is defined as the in-medium thermal mass of the jape psi. So it's the simplest thing you could do, and it happens to fit the holographic prediction to a very good accuracy. So, but there's certainly some modeling involved, that's for sure. And you also need to know how the limiting velocity depends on the temperature, because that determines this dispersion relation. And for that, I use, if you forget about this term, this is the heuristic relationship I gave you before, remember, for the existence of a limiting velocity. And this extra term just accounts for the fact that in holographic models, at T equal T dissociation, the limiting velocity is not zero. It's offset by some quantity, which can be 0.2, 0.3. Okay, so again, a little bit more modeling, but that's as well as, you know, as well as you can do, really. Okay, so this is the result. If you put everything together, you plug it into Mathematica, and you ask it to numerically integrate the signal and the background, this is what you get. The blue curve, so this is the number of photons, thermal photons, as a function of the energy of the photon. The blue curve is the exponentially decreasing thermal spectrum for light quarks, which has no structure because, as I told you, the spectral function has no structure. The red curve is the peak coming from the jape psi convoluted with the space-time evolution of the fireball. And what you see is that it's not as narrow as it would be because the omega peak is actually moving when the temperature drops. Okay. And the black curve is the sum of the two. And this plot is for a dissociation temperature of the jape psi taken to be 1.25 TC, where TC is 175 MeVs. Okay? So there are a lot of uncertainties, and the model is very simple. But if you believe it as an order of magnitude estimate, it could give you a peak that's visible with your naked eye. This is, this is for LHC energies. And the reason I'm saying this is because the magnitude of the signal is proportional to the square of the CC bar cross section in the initial partonic collisions. Okay? Now, this is the same physics, but where the dissociation temperature is 2.5 TC. And then you see that you don't get such a pronounced peak, but you still get an enhancement. And if you integrate the excess given by this effect, that's still measurable. But of course, it's not as spectacular.
This is the temperature at which the CC bar would unbind as you heat the system up.
Yes.
Well, here, it's actually where they're recombining. I mean, the name is backwards. Because
it's the same thing.
Right. But in fact, what's happening at that temperature is
they recombine, yes.
Yeah. Why? So higher?
Yeah, yeah.
This higher is a sooner recombination.
Yes.
So why is the signal smaller?
The reason for that is that actually also confused me, but the reason is that here, because they recombine at a later time, the volume is way bigger.
Oh, okay, yeah.
By, I think, two orders of magnitude, something like that. So this fireball expands, and what you want, so remember there's a combination of effects. One is that this effect is exponentially suppressed if you go to high frequencies. So what you want is that the lowest frequency, the omega peak, occurs at the latest time so that the volume is bigger there. So you don't pay the price of an exponential suppression, and you gain in volume. That's why.
And you're assuming that they recombine right away when this temperature is reached. I mean, they have to find each other. Are they?
That goes into all the uncertainties in these models. But you would expect that. So that depends on what the density is. If the density is very high, so people argue about whether coalescence or recombination of uncorrelated CC bars can happen.
They're uncorrelated. They're
formed. So at RIG, you don't really expect that to happen because the density is too low. But of course, when you go to LHC energies, the number of CC bars is way, way bigger. So it may happen. Nobody really knows that. So what I'm doing is taking one model where this gives you an order one effect, and you know, arguing that that's the case in this model. If the physics is different, this may go away. Yeah.
So the number of CC bars you make is constant. I mean, you make them in the collision, and then it expands, and the density just goes down.
Yeah.
But I didn't understand why you get an enhancement from larger volumes. It's still, I mean, isn't it just, you know, each CC bar pair gives you?
No, they need to recombine. So the total number of CC bars, whether they are unbound or combined in, you know, a light quark, C quark bound state, or CC bar bound state, the total number is constant. But you only get this effect if they bind into an object that then, because it's in the medium, has a modified dispersion relation. So there are a number of observations that I should make about this result. The first one is that this result is exponentially sensitive, because remember, these are thermally produced photons, and there are exponentials all over the place. So you change a little bit, some parameter, it goes away, it comes back, you know. So it may or may not be there. All I've done here is choose a reasonable, you know, is to demonstrate that there's a reasonable choice of parameters for which you get an effect of order one. Okay, but to be honest, I have to emphasize that this is exponentially sensitive to many uncertainties. So in particular, whether you get a peak or just an enhancement depends very sensitively on that. The second point is that it's quadratically sensitive to the number of CC bar pairs produced in partonic collisions. And this explains why you don't expect to see this at RIG. Because the CC bar cross-section for PP collisions, the initial collisions, at LHC is 10 times bigger than at RIG. So that, because it's quadratic, it's a factor of 100. So this effect is suppressed by two orders of magnitude at RIG, the red curve.
Cross-sections fall with energy?
No, they grow. So the CC, you produce many more CC bars if you collide heavy energy at LHC than at RIG. Let me also say, since you ask me, that actually, sorry?
Relatively? Other things?
No, this is just, if you ask, if I collide the same two ions at RIG energies or at LHC energies, in which one do I produce more CC bar pairs? And the answer is by a factor of 10 at LHC.
Well,
from PDFs because it's more small lattice?
It's from a lot of things. There's a lot of, in fact, the if you ask the experts, they will tell you that the cross-section for CC bar is actually, the uncertainty is at least an order of magnitude. Yes, if you ask, for example, Matteo Cacciari, that's what he'll tell you. So actually, I'm taking here a very moderate. If I had taken the extreme value, this peak would be up here. So I'm actually, you know.
R is uncertain to an order of magnitude?
Yeah. At LHC, yes.
That's from uncertainty in PDFs or in something else?
No matter how you try to determine it, either experimental by extrapolating from experiments at SPS and RIC, you get an uncertainty. If you try to determine it theoretically in PQCD, just from factorization and renormalization dependence and all of that, you get an order of magnitude.
But the Higgs is supposed to. I mean, it's not so. It's also the smallest part of the PDFs, and they think they know that too. I don't know.
As I said in this conference last week, in fact, I was in a talk that was exclusively dedicated to discussing what is the uncertainty in the CC var cross section at RIG and LHC, and the conclusion is an order of magnitude. Well, this is so this number of CC bars is actually obtained by taking the cross section for PP collisions and then multiplying by the number of collisions. Yeah. So, but in any case, it seems clear that at RIC it's at least 10 times smaller. So that strongly suggests that unless you're really, really lucky, this is going to be suppressed at RIC as compared to LHC by two orders of magnitude. So probably you won't see it. But at LHC, it could be seen, I think. And another thing that's that works out well is that, as you see, the location of the peak is essentially set by the JPSI mass. Because remember, omega peak is the point where that curve that starts at the JPSI mass crosses the light cone. So it's a little bigger than the rest mass, but not way bigger. So the location of the peak is between 3 and 5 GeV. And that's perfect because here I'm just arguing that this effect is comparable to the thermal background. But you have to compare it too to the peak ECD background, remember? And if you look at the prediction for LHC, the blue curve is the PQCD background, photons. These are photons produced at LHC in hard collisions, initial collisions, before the Coriolis plasma gets formed. And the brown curve, which you can't see very well, but it goes down here, is the thermal background coming from light quarks. And you see that the two curves cross around 4.5 GeV. So that means that anywhere below 5 GeV, the number of photons produced thermally is comparable or bigger than the PQCD background. Okay? So if you show that this signal is order one compared to the thermal, to the blue curve, sorry, to the brown curve, it also tells you that it's at least order one or bigger compared to the blue curve. Okay? So it's in the right range to be observed. For the upsilon, for example, which is a BB bar and hence much heavier vector meson, the peak, so the upsilon has a mass of around 9 or 10 GeV. The peak is at least at 10 GeV. And if you go to 10 GeV here, you see that the peak ECD background falls off like a power law, whereas the brown thermal spectrum falls off exponentially. And this is a logarithmic curve, logarithmic plot. So if you go to 10 or 11 GeV, even if you get a huge peak from the upsilon, it's unlikely that you'll see it because the peak you see the background is going to kill you. Okay. So I'm running out of time. I think I'm going to skip the summary, but I will leave you with two slides on future prospects. One is that LHC will also run heavy ion collisions, as I said, not just high energy collisions. And I think there'll be interesting physics there. So we need more universal predictions from string theory, more peaks. And the second one is that the dispersion relation, which is very universal in these models that I told you about, may also have implications and applications because it's so universal and robust, to the connection with condensed matter physics, for which we have a fast growing number of references and some experts in the audience. So I think thinking about that is also interesting because it could have implications for systems that you can actually really engineer in the lab. So I'll leave you with that. Thank you.
You had universal in your title. How many different kinds of brain setups have you tried?
I skipped this part, but this is true for all.
I mean, you argued actually independent of string theory, so.
So there are two aspects. One is, if you ask in holographic models,
yes,
is there any counterexample to this in a model that has mesons? And the answer is no. So it's completely universal.
It's kind of,
yeah, because it only depends on the black hole and the brains being there. That gives you this expression.
Sakai
Sugimoto also will give you this. Any model where you have mesons.
This transition is not related to chiral symmetry breaking, is it? Or
No.
Right. Okay.
There is some connection, but it's completely irrelevant here. It just depends on the fact that a brain in a black hole background can sit outside or inside. It's as simple as that. If it sits outside, there's a redshift, there's a limiting velocity, and there is a peak. And as you're saying, the other point is that even if QCD does not have a string dual, if these two conditions are satisfied, then you should get a peak. So it's actually more universal than in string, than in the context of string theory. And this, of course, is something that some people in other communities really like because they may not be so sympathetic to string predictions.
I mean, there is the people working on charm, obviously, just from QCD. And had they talked about this before?
No, I don't think anybody has ever realized this. And in fact, the only reason I started thinking about this is because I was playing with brains in black hole backgrounds and so on, and we got this dispersion relation. And then when you start talking to people and reading literature, you realize that actually these two assumptions were already.
So the phase velocity is C, even though the group velocity is much less than C.
Right. Right.
So this limiting velocity less than the speed of light had been noticed in some other context?
Actually, let me just correct. The phase velocity is not C.
Omega over K
is not C. It's not 1. No.
Oh.
No. And that, I'm glad you asked that because, actually, let me show you this one. So this asymptotically has omega over k. You can see this is 60 and this is 25.
Right.
So it becomes a straight line with a slope that's smaller than 1.
Where they intersect, omega
over here.
K is 1.
Yes. Yeah. But beyond that, it becomes space-like.
Right.
And that actually, I didn't say this, but another universal consequence of that is that there's going to be Cherenkov radiation.
Mm.
If you have a fast-moving quark in this plasma with a velocity that's bigger than this limiting velocity for the Jape psi, okay, it's going to radiate a shock wave of Jape size with an angle that you can predict and a spectrum that you can predict. So this would appear in your detector as a cone of decay products of the Jape psi with an angle that you can predict. Okay, so this is something that when I spoke about this last week, people were very excited about. And this is actually what I think has a more direct connection to condensed matter. Because if you have any excitations in your system that have a dispersion relation like this, and you have something that couples to those excitations and moves faster, you get this shockwave, Cherenkov radiation.
Okay, thank you.